everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we are joined, as always, by you, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
We are getting smarter this week, Chicago style, with the mayor of that great city, Rahm Emanuel, is his name.
Yes. And before we do anything else, though, we're just going to play you some tape of all of us getting settled in, because just meeting the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, all by itself, and meeting is slightly a strong word because he's apparently not that into introductions, is a story. And so we're gonna pick this up as he is asking us how much he can physically move his body around with a microphone in his face.
Right. I'm allowed to.
You can do whatever you want. Yep. It's your conference room.
Yeah, well, that'll be the first time in 5 years having a meeting here where somebody said, this is your conference room. You can do whatever you want.
Really?
Yeah.
I think you're letting all the wrong people in
here.
Yeah,
right? Thanks for taking the time.
Sure.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. We should have different conditions to meet each other.
Like, if we're just already in a fight.
Yeah.
I say nice to meet you because we have not in any way introduced ourselves. And from that first second that we all sit down, the mayor is challenging even the simplest premise. Although we did find out he moves around a lot, so that was actually a pretty smart question for him to ask. But his constant challenging, this is a guy who likes to fight. And that is, in fact, what he has spent the last 25 years in Democratic politics doing.
In fact, I raised that point to him, his pugnaciousness, and he challenged me a little bit. And I think you'll probably hear a little bit of that in the tape that we're going to play. But his story is pretty well known in Democratic circles, right? Mm-hmm. Raised lots of money for Bill Clinton in his first presidential campaign. He got elected to the House. He ran the House campaign committee, retaking control of the House of Representatives. 2009, leaves Congress, goes to work for Obama as his first chief of staff, which you will also hear about in this tape. And then in late 2010, he says, I'm going to go home to Chicago and run for the mayorship.
Yeah. And I saw him speak at this sort of off the record event here in San Francisco, because I will tell you a little secret about Silicon Valley. Their only weakness is people who they perceive to have more power than them. They're obsessed with like the DC set because there's this whole other universe of power that confuses Silicon Valley. So they love to have guys like Rahm come in and talk. And listening to him, I realized he is talking about a lot of the things that we've been talking about on this podcast, the ongoing changes, obviously, in the economic and political power structure in America, whether government should be run as a business, whether business or local governments can be checks on government overreach. And of course, as the federal government gets more and more paralyzed, whether power is shifting from the federal level back to states and cities.
Because here's the thing about Rahm Emanuel, whether you like him or not, whether you voted for him or not, whether you think he's a terrible mayor or whatever or not, he knows political power. I mean, at all levels, and more importantly, at all levels of his own personal political popularity, too.
Yeah, oh my God. This is a straight up steal. I'm stealing this line from our producer, Jenny Josephson, because she said, if Rahm Emanuel's poll numbers were a roller coaster, they would not let you ride it at Six Flags. But he does not care.
Boom, boom. There was a teacher strike in 2012 in Chicago, very high profile. In 2014, a Chicago police officer killed a black teenager named Laquan McDonald, shot him 16 times while he was laying on the ground. I'm sure you've seen the video. If not, look it up because it's troubling. City's response to that was horrible, horrible, horrible.
Yep. In fact, that shooting, I think it's fair to say, has been the defining event of the mayor's two terms in office, you know, notwithstanding all of the other crime in that city. After a court, though, finally ordered the release of the video right after, by the way, the mayor was very narrowly reelected. They finally released the video, and then there were calls for his resignation. Chicago Magazine called him the least popular mayor in modern Chicago history. And last year, of course, Chicago faced the worst wave of violence in nearly 20 years. It goes on and on.
Yeah, it's violence that continues to this day. And I hate to keep saying this, but you'll hear about this in the tape that's coming up. And then, of course, in November, President Trump gets elected, and he goes after Rahm Emanuel. He goes after the city of Chicago. He threatens to, and this is a quote from the president of the United States, send in the feds. And then all of a sudden you start looking at Chicago and you say, you know what? Maybe having a mayor who knows politics and knows political fighting is not such a bad thing for that city. To quote a local writer in Chicago, I'm going to sort of semi-quote him. To use a Chicago term, Mayor Emanuel might be a jerk, but he's our jerk. I'm not going to say that word on the pod. Get out of here. No, I don't want that E thing, because then Apple will yell at us and we'll get the E and then parents won't be able to hear it. And I'm not doing that.
That's not a bad word.
Go ahead. You say it. I'm not saying it.
It's jagoff. This is not a bad word.
It's a bad word.
He may be a Jagoff, but he's our Jagoff. Come on, that's awesome.
So I look like the priss now. Thank you very much. That's great.
You know what? We'll fix it in post. We'll fix it in post.
I got coffee coming out of my nose. We'll fix it in post. Anyway, Rahm Emanuel.
Rahm Emanuel, he challenges the premise, I think we can safely say, and he is loving this fight with Trump already. Yeah. In fact, just the most recent thing that he did to provoke was essentially post the entire climate change page that was deleted from the federal EPA website and say, I will not go quietly into this climate change night. So we talked to him at 8:30 a.m. on a Friday morning. He was, of course, armed with a ton of facts that paint a very different picture of the Chicago that we have talked about. And then speaking of the table, I think it's important to note here that when you listen to this interview, you're going to hear a lot of knocking and rapping noises. And that is the mayor pounding on the table to make a point, which he does a lot. We were supposed to talk for 30 minutes. 45 minutes later, I think this was bonding, really. We were all still talking. He was still talking.
It was a good conversation. And he's clearly a guy who could go on forever and ever and ever. We split this thing into three rounds. The first bit, which you'll hear now, is based on a question we got from Rob Bennett. Rob wants to know, can sanctuary cities like my hometown of Chicago actually afford to stand up to the federal government? Because, of course, President Trump has threatened to take all that money away from those cities.
Yeah, we had a hell of a conversation about that. Oh, I did another swear. A heck of a conversation about that.
You are a bad person.
But before we get to that, Kai started off with one simple question.
I'm just going to climb right in and ask you from back long ago, why did you want this job?
First of all, I'm serious. This is the greatest city in the greatest country. That's one. Two, on a professional political level, what we grew up knowing about nation states, they're broken. Cities are the places where you can still put your thumb on the scale and move and make things happen. I think there's 100 cities that are the economic, cultural, and intellectual energy centers of the world economy, and Chicago's one of them. And again, let me give you an anecdote of what I mean. I did a lot of things different at our community colleges. We have the second largest system in the United States of America. I set up that if you get a B average in high school, community college is free. Only city in the United States. If you keep the B average in community college, every university, all 16 in the city of Chicago, will offer you anything from 25 to 50% off of tuition. You can go to college in Chicago for a year and a half of cost. You can make a fundamental difference. And still, I could argue about this in Congress. I think I was kind of a significant chief of staff. I can argue about it as chief.
So you
can do things that are... Wait a second. You asked me one question, so I got like four answers for you. So
yeah, I know. And we've only got a half an hour, Mr. Mayor. So
how are we counting, Jewish or non-Jewish time?
Yeah, well, that's your call.
So my point is, you can do things and that are, whether on education, I could talk to you about infrastructure, I could talk to you about like rediscovering the river for Chicago. You cannot do that nationally. And that's true about Paris, it's true about London, it's true about Berlin, and Chicago's a world-class city.
My question, though, as a follow-up is that a new realization for you? Because you're sitting in a chair that says on the back, Chief of Staff, January 20th, 2009.
I had to buy it.
You had to buy it? They didn't buy
you
it for
did?
You?
No, they don't.
Will you tell us how much it cost?
What is that?
No.
Come on.
No, the chief, first of all, is the chief of staff that was part of the cabinet. Every cabinet secretary is allowed to buy. We're wasting time of our half hour here on something so stupid.
Well, so but it gets to a larger point.
So actually, yes, that is true. And so I bought it when I left. And it kind of has my tush indentured, so I keep it.
but the point being, you functioned at the highest level of national politics for a very long time. And then you said, hey, I want to be the mayor of Chicago.
Yeah. Well, let me give you the counter.
Sure.
You go ask Mike Bloomberg, who's one of the most successful businessmen, and ask him what is his favorite, CEO of Bloomberg or CEO of New York City, and he'll tell you CEO of New York City. Would that count as a slap down?
No, that's a snap. That's
okay,
no snap.
Good. No slap down, not snap. so here is, here's what I was, on a serious note, and then there's a personal thing to me.
Yeah.
This is the 100-year anniversary where my grandfather on my mother's side, at 13 years old, left the pogroms of Eastern Europe by himself, came to the city, third grade education, not a word of English, and his grandson is the mayor of this great city. I think it's the story of America. I think it's an unbelievable promise of this great city, And at every level, if you grew up in this city, you know what the mayor can do. And this is a city that gave my family a chance at the American dream. And I owe it something. And I'm hopefully making a difference.
You have nicely segued right into my current obsession, which is, which these guys know all too well,
is
the city, the power of the city, and almost the sort of return to the idea of the city state, like Rome or Florence or Istanbul or Beirut, right? But especially now,
I hope you dropped that last one, Beirut.
I have a whole obsession on Beirut before, and you know, what's the role of the city, especially now as people are migrating to cities, as you know, by our recent polling, 74% of Americans feel left behind by the federal government. What can cities do?
It's interesting because it taps an economic and a political point. On the economic, my analysis of the last national election, like other national elections, they are more angry at the political system than they are the economic system because the political system has not responded to the economic system.
Right.
That's also true of Brexit. If you look around the world, they're taking a hammer to the political systems. So economically on a city, but let me just talk about my home, my city. Last 4 years, Chicago's economy grew faster than the nation and faster than New York and D.C. each year for the last 4 years. It has 16 universities. We have an unparalleled aviation system. Our cost of living is 10th out of the 10 biggest cities. It's the only time I never wanted to be number one. And you could put policies either that can move that with challenges that we have, and that's not, but those are the highlights on the affirmative side. And then politically, local government is the most immediate and intimate form of government where people think it influences their lives. It's where they send their kids to schools. It's where they have either a park and they want to see something happen in that park. It's a where the library is. It's how they, you know, it's where a streetlight will go or not go. And it's the government they feel they can still touch and direct. And in a period of time where you feel like you're powerless with overwhelming forces, local government is this place where people politically actually know they can, not just feel, so it's not just an impression, influence. And that is why in this period of time, the nation state is ineffective and people feel most connected to their local government.
Yeah, no, and I get that. But in this current moment, when the President of the United States is going after you personally and cities across this country for the sanctuary city movement, the Attorney General keeps saying he's going to come after you. The President goes after you by name. When you wake up in the morning and read that, what do you do?
I look forward to doing an interview with Marketplace. No, on a serious note, look, first of all, on the piece as it relates to, I call us a welcoming city.
Specifically not sanctuary.
Specifically not sanctuary. We're a welcoming city. We're the city that welcomes my grandfather and welcomes people today who believe that tomorrow can be better for their children and grandchildren. That is ultimately what America stands for. America is not a place. It is a set of ideas and values. And I will not turn our back as the mayor on not only our past, but what I think is our future. And your journey across the Atlantic, your journey across the Pacific, your journey across the Rio or up the Mississippi still counts. You know, we have 140 languages spoken in our public schools, but one vision for your children. Now, on the other hand, I'm also right legally. That's exactly what the judge said, that the President of the United States and the Attorney General were wrong on the Constitution, wrong on the law, and I will tell you this, they're wrong on the values of this country. And you can't blackmail us into turning our back on our values.
How high stakes does it get? I mean, blackmail is not a totally inappropriate word. How high stakes does it get?
You can say, you know, the word, if you go, I'm not a lawyer, but I actually know something about, thank God. The basis of the court's decision is based on the word, the federal government coercing.
Right.
They used a nice homogenized term. Coercing is one word. Blackmail is another word. Let me give you one anecdote if I can.
Of course you can.
Okay. 26th Street in Chicago runs through the heart of Little Village of Mexican-American community. Do you know it produces more sales tax revenue for the city of Chicago than any other part except for Michigan Avenue? Because people come from Columbus, Ohio, to Minneapolis and everything between to come there to shop. I call it the Magnificent 2 Miles. In January and February. Sales were off there by 30 to 40% because people were scared to go out, shop for groceries, products, things that they, how to live their lives, still proud of who they were as Mexican Americans. Never in my wildest imaginations did I think the United States government, in the name of the American people, would create that type of fear in people that see themselves and live their lives as Americans. I cannot be part of a country and accept without my voice being heard the idea that the United States government would bring that type of fear, given the history. And if you go to museums throughout Judea, not just Israel, but across Europe and the United States, there's always a recognition of what are called the righteous, people who are not Jews who sacrifice their being for Jews. And if you're in a position of power, and the mayor is a position of power, it is incumbent upon us to use that to help people who don't have that voice, because others did it for us. And I will never be allow the United States to be what it isn't. And I think I have a responsibility that goes beyond just the pragmatics of politics.
If those
Do you want to ask another question on this?
Are you saying you're just going to go on and on? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
I could go on about it. I really think there's a moment always in politics. Look, I'm not scared.
My only question is if those people are already staying home, what can a city do?
We've done a lot. March is actually back to normal. As the mayor, I've been clear to the kids and clear to their parents. You are safe, you are secure, and you are supported in this city. And the city will never allow you to be scared of being a part of this city.
We are going to get back to that bit about being safe in the city of Chicago coming up in just a little bit, just so you know.
And we're going to, you know, have some water and put a towel around our necks and get ready for round two.
All right, more from Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of the great city of Chicago, in just a little bit. First, though, the Make Me Smart Book Club, and it has its first official selection. Ta-da!
How to start a book club.
Books are fun.
I have my own book club.
Oh, I just can't wait to read a book.
Let me just say that we got more than 800 votes, and clearly nobody listened to me when I tried to instruct y'all on how, you know, you ought to vote last time.
That's right. You, dear listener, much like me and my early basketball career, are uncoachable, and I like it. With 36.9% of the vote, we will be reading The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, which was suggested by Scott Weinman. And Kai, maybe this is going to help, because I know you said you didn't want to read this.
Yeah.
The Man in the High Castle, by the way, came in second. So you listened a little bit. Not all the way. Scott heard your concerns about the book. He wrote you a note, you personally.
What did he say?
He said, Kai, please psych yourself up for Hate's The Righteous Mind. It is the kind of book that this podcast was born to digest. Hate has been on my radar for a while now, and I was surprised to see that this book has been out since 2012, and it was a TED Talk back in 2008. It's about time Hate answers the Make Me Smart question.
Great. So now I've got homework out of my own podcast. I don't know how we got here. But anyway, we're going to take 3 weeks plus or minus to read that book. May the 23rd, we're going to talk about it. So when you read the book, send us a voice memo of what you thought, maybe questions for the author. We will see if we can get him on the show, actually, to talk about it and answer the Make Me Smart question.
Yeah, I think that would be great. That's my birthday, by the way.
Really?
So thanks for the birthday gift to me, because this is totally the book I wanted to read. And Scott, thank you for suggesting the winning book. You, sir, are getting a Make Me Smart pop socket. Send us your street address to makemesmart@marketplace.org, and we will put that in the mail. Next up, we are going to talk to Rahm Emanuel about the city's credit rating. That gets surprisingly heated, because even though it sounds boring. And why Kai would apparently make a great Jewish mother.
Who knew?
But before that, much like the city of Chicago, ba-dum-bum, we got to pay the bills. Oh, my goodness. Can I just interject? Tough, huh? Can I just have a teeny tangent?
Yeah.
Right after we went to Chicago, I flew directly to New Orleans for a conference. But before the conference, I went to Jazz Fest. And at Jazz Fest, I had one of those truly magical musical moments in the blues tent, listening to Johnny Lang. And I came out of it absolutely convinced that I have to, like, get super into blues and, like, teach my kid how to play blues guitar.
How's that going, though, as you get back to schlepping him to school and doing work and being sick and, you know, all that jazz?
I don't think he's going to do it.
All right.
But I have added a lot of it to my Spotify.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's get back to round two of our interview with Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel.
Some things you need to know about Chicago for this next bit. First of all, in 2011, when Rahm Emanuel was first elected to the mayor, Chicago's finances, their pension fund specifically, were in terrible shape. At one point, the underfunding estimate was like $18.5 billion. That's according to Bloomberg, which then in turn made the creditworthiness of the city also terrible. 2015, Chicago became the only major U.S. city outside of Detroit, which, of course, is bankrupt, with a junk rating on its bonds. So the mayor and the alderman of the great city of Chicago passed a record property tax increase to help fund those pensions. But you have to know that a lot of that money also depends on funding from the state of Illinois, and that's a whole nother deal. So takeaway here is that Chicago's finances were in a mess, and Emanuel's had to deal with that.
Yeah, which only adds to the question of why do you want this job?
Right.
This is also the sort of basic background of what you need to know to keep up with round two. This is a guy who assumes a lot of knowledge on your part. So that's the background for round two of our interview with the mayor.
You talked a lot about the economic development in the city. I wonder, though, whether that's all the high-profile headline stuff and the underpinnings of having billions of dollars in debt and the city's credit rating being terrible. How can those two sustain each other?
Well, first of all, that's not totally accurate. I would just tell you, since the tough decisions we made, S&P and Fitch upgraded their outlook on the city of Chicago.
Yeah, but Moody's hasn't, though, right? So
okay, well, there's showing what there's the bias of a journalist. I gave you two in a positive, and you gave me one in a negative, and you focused on
it. I like to call it context, right?
But okay, well, then let's...
Not everything is sunshine and light.
No, but let's be... What you did focus on is Moody's. Then let's focus on Moody's, Fitch, S&P, and Kroll's. All
sure.
Four, not one. Fitch upgraded to stable, as did S&P, as did Kroll's. Yes, Moody's did what they did. I think there's a... We have a fundamental disagreement with Moody's. Why did they do that, though, S&P, Fitch, and Kroll? Three out of the four. The reason is because when I came into office, we were running about a 20% structural deficit.
Mm-hmm.
And we've reduced that by 80-plus percent. Now, I rejected what other people said, just raise taxes or just slash government. We've both done revenue reform together, and we've brought our structural deficit fundamentally down and taken out every bad trick and trade that was hiding the real cost of government, but one, and we'll have that on a path to elimination by 2019. The second is all four pensions for the city were headed towards being solvent,
mm-hmm.
and they're now all on a fundamentally path towards solvency. And we did it because in the end of the day, also not putting the economy in a recession, but by growing the economy. Ultimately, the answer to all these challenges are growing the economy and growing jobs. I call what we have is the five T's of economic strategy, all right? Training, technology, transportation, transparency, and talent. That, to me, is what builds an economy. The public finances is a tool in that toolbox, is not the toolbox. And I actually think too much of the discussion nationally, and I was even saying our state, is all about one aspect. One of the things I'm critical about our state about is because of what they're doing to our places of higher learning, they're undermining the fundamental long-term growth of the state.
Through the state's budget problems, right?
Yeah.
Just to frame that.
Yeah. So that, to me, the budget problems are now jumping the tracks into the higher education. And that, you can get the, if you got the budget right, but you're undermining higher public education, you're not going to solve your long-term or short-term economic pieces.
So acknowledging that you're the mayor of Chicago and your authority ends at the city limits, continue that thought for me into the wider economy in this country, right? And the disconnect between the wealthy and the working class, mm-hmm. and getting back to what you said at the beginning of the interview, how that hammer was brought down on the political system.
Yeah. I was going to joke. This is a joke, so let me preface. I'm now for a wall. I'd like to keep everybody out, everybody from the Chicago limits and the rest of Illinois out of, I want to keep Springfield out of Chicago, and I'm for the wall. So, and that's a joke. Okay. So your question is...
I like how you tell me that. I could take a joke.
I know, you can. I try, yeah.
Okay. What, I'm the non-joke guy? No, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I cannot, no.
You're, from now on, I'm going to call Mr. Moody's Doom and Gloom. So here is missing S&P, Fitch, and Kroll. Have you ever tried out as a Jewish mother? You would really
no,
do well.
No, I never
well.
Have. But, well, I'm not even going to go
I'll write
there.
The letter of recommendation for you.
Moody's Doom and Gloom right here. That's me. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You know, so it's really interesting listening back to that interview. And I will confess now that yeah. I haven't heard that since we actually got out of that conference room. And it's funny to hear him. It's funny to hear my missed opportunity, right? So there are three big credit rating agencies, Moody's, S&P, and Fitch. And then he pulls out a fourth, Kroll, which is like a minor league rating agency. And if you work for Kroll, please, please, please don't write in. And I did not mean to be pejorative, right? But there are the big three.
Like you're just getting yourself in
and
more
then,
trouble.
And then there's another one that the mayor pulled out because it voted for him.
Right.
Right. And I really should have poked a stick back in his eye, but I didn't in the moment. And that bugs me.
Oh, I mean, I leave every interview with at least the one follow-up question that it killed me that I didn't ask. But that was apparently the Moody's thing I was talking to. You'll hear in a minute about this guy, Grant. I had a little back and forth with Grant afterward about how the Moody's thing just kills them. It just drives them crazy.
Interesting.
They feel like it's like how Steph Curry never gets the foul call. Like Moody's just doesn't like them.
All right. Anyway, a little more Chicago Blues, I think, coming up. And then we're going to go to school or perhaps get schooled. I'm not sure which it is with the mayor of Chicago.
Oh, my God, the Blues. I can't get enough. Wow. All right. We're back. We're ready for round three. Here's the background on that, because you have probably noticed a theme in the mayor's comments, and that theme is education, which would lead you to believe that he is a huge fan, which he is. However, in 2012, Chicago public school teachers went on strike for 7 days. They were demanding better benefits and job security and training and all of those things. The mayor, though, came into office wanting a longer school day and school year, but by most accounts didn't want to pay for those things. No surprise, it got contentious. This is where you're going to hear me mention Grant, and you're going to be like, who's Grant? And it's Grant Klinsman. Klinsman? He worked in the mayor's office.
It was,
it is his job.
He was a big, burly dude with a beard. That's the only way I remember.
So big. Yeah, he was so big, and he had such a great beard, and he has the worst job in America, which is to keep the mayor.
Trying to keep Rahm Emanuel on time.
On schedule.
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
Sorry. Brain fart. Let's just leave that right in there, shall we? Should we leave
You were just
that
thinking
there?
About the beard.
Well, I was, because honestly, I think it needs to be trimmed, but that was, you know, that was just me.
Oh, no.
That was just me. Yeah. Anyway, here, really? You know, anyway, whatever.
Yeah. No. Mm-mm.
All right. Anyway, third and final round with Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Here you go.
There's a great quote. I think it's from David Axelrod in some of the prep I was reading for this interview. Axelrod, of course, in the Obama White House with you. And he said, I wonder if maybe being mayor has taught Rahm a little bit of empathy. What do you think of that?
Well, I love David. And David, not only we worked together in the White House, he was in my wedding.
I know.
We're dear friends. I would say to you, this is a moment of self-awareness. I've always had empathy. I always cared.
So what, did you just not let it show?
Well, first of all, I disagree with, you know, just because you think there's a... First of all, this is your first time meeting me.
That is correct.
All you know is what you've read, and you don't...
And seen.
Okay. But you don't know me, and you basically... And just because other journalists write about stereotypes doesn't mean that's not who the whole person is. You couldn't... Listen, just to all the people that write about stereotypes... You couldn't be a dancer if you didn't have a connection to emotions and a way of communicating them.
And we have to point out here that not everybody's going to know that you studied dance seriously when you were a kid.
Yeah. So David may be right, but he may not be totally right. Maybe being mayor, unlike being a congressman or chief of staff, you know, it's not like chief of staff lends itself to public expressions of empathy. Maybe mayor, you always had them, but they're being mayor gives you that because it has a different moral standing than chief of staff. Chief of staff, you're there to enforce somebody else's policies.
We talked to a couple residents, namely a cab driver. Our producer had this great conversation with a cab driver, and this gets to exactly the exchange you just had. Because what he said, so what one person at Drinks last night said was the feeling is that there's only an open door for the wealthy. And then what the cab driver said is, if I could ask the mayor one question, it would be, how do we know you? Mm-hmm. How do we know? And he said, I drive through all parts of the city, and some of them look like a third world country, and some of them look
That's true.
Completely the opposite. And how do we bring those closer together?
Well, that's a different, those are two questions, not one.
Well, yeah.
Okay. So
how do we know you? We could start there. That's a good one.
Well, no, how do you know me? It's actually, people have been in people's living rooms for 6 years. Some parts of what I know, people know about me, is only through the news. That's not, we're no more than this interview captures who you are and everything about you. It doesn't capture everything about me. And part of my job is also, while I'm a private person and a parent, I mean, let me say this. I will make a case. I've never, if you go back in my campaigns, you never see my children. They're my children. They're not wardrobes for my politics. Okay? Second is, Chicago's not the only city in the world. In fact, it's reflective of every city in the world where there is great wealth within 3 miles of great poverty. Whether you live in Ravenswood, where Amy and I and our kids live, or you live in Roseland, which is on the far south side, what stabilizes and strengthens a neighborhood and community are the kind of basics of a community that only a city can invest in. And the most important thing then for the wealth or well-being of that neighborhood is education.
It's funny because the only other question that I got from you from my friend who used to live in Chicago was, why are all the teachers mad at you?
Well, because I...
Which seems a little different from the...
Well, that's okay. I mean...
What are they not getting from your message?
First of all, I'm not so sure that's an accurate, and that could be an old take. That said, because I meet with teachers regularly sitting right in this room. Look, we had a disagreement about a full school day and a full school year.
Yeah.
We had the shortest school day and the shortest school year in the United States of America. I do not think it's a coincidence that once we've gotten a full school day and a full school year, Chicago's children, eighth graders, led the United States in math gains, and fourth graders led the United States in reading it. Our kids were always capable about it. Everybody else sitting around a negotiating table dealt them out. I made a pledge, and I was willing to take a strike to get it. It was not against teachers. It was for children.
So here comes the poke in the eye question. You want to keep kids in school, which is great. Mm-hmm. But in Chicago right now, there's a wave of violence that's not letting kids stay alive to stay in schools.
Well, first of all, being in schools were the safest place for kids, which is why we've also doubled our investment not only in school, but after school. Our responsibility to children don't end because the bell goes off at 3:30. We've actually, in a tough budget, in which you were talking about on the economic side, mm-hmm. even while I was cutting the budget, every year I increased after school and summer jobs. When I became mayor, 14,000 kids, 14,500, had summer jobs. Today it's 31,000. And we did it in the face of federal cutbacks and state cutbacks. We do have a challenge primarily on the southwest side, and we're addressing it through after school, summer jobs, and universal mentoring. And all three have been dramatically expanded in the time of fiscal restraint and reforms and abandonment by the federal government and the state government of Illinois. Every one of them. And I actually would turn the question around if I could.
Of course you can.
If you actually go back in public policy and look, in the last 40 years, outside of what President Clinton did in kids' care and what President Johnson did in Head Start, you can't find a single investment that's totally dedicated to children. And our de-investment in our children is the very thing that's undermining the United States. I think the federal government's broken because they are basically paying interest on the debt and paying for the military and entitlements. And that's it. So we're going to be mirrors of the federal government. And if you believe in progressive politics, which I do, the question is, how do we continue to do what we need to do but invest in the future and not do what the federal government's done? Because I think what the federal government's done as over the last 50 years is exactly wrong for the future of this country.
Over the past 50 years, Democrats and Republicans alike,
totally.
Except for the exceptions you mentioned, so the question has to be, with the current political environment in Washington...
I would add one other person to that list.
Yeah, I know you would.
because he did do it with healthcare.
He should have bought you that chair, I'm just saying. Yeah.
He didn't have his book signing then.
Oh, please. It's not like he needed the book signing. Or the speeches, but that's a whole different thing. Is there anything that gives you hope on the national level?
Well, actually, the American people. And I do. I mean, I haven't given up. I'm down on it, but I've never given up on it. And I'll tell you one anecdote. Every question has one.
We're going to do a super cut, by the way, of you saying, I'm going to tell you one anecdote. That's right. It's going to be amazing.
It's going to, just there you sounded like Trump. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be big. It's going to be huge. It's unbelievable. You actually have to say it twice for it to be Trump-like, okay?
You're right.
It's going to be amazing. I mean amazing, okay? So here's my routine. In the morning, I go swim a mile. I come back to the house, have a quick breakfast with the kids. When they were younger, they wanted to do it. Now they don't even want me to wake them up. And then they leave, and then I go up, take a shower, get on the way to work. So it was like the second or third day of the strike. And it was stressful, for lack of a better, people are outside your house. There's teachers outside your kids' school protesting. Stressful on a number of levels. As I'm getting ready to go out the door, Amy looks at me and goes, we're having a battle over a full school day and a full school year. She goes, I've seen you through an impeachment. I've seen you through NAFTA. I've seen you through two national campaigns. I've seen you through the congressional piece. I've seen you through healthcare. These are all kind of milestones of my professional life and our relationship at one level. She goes, I've never seen you calmer. And I said, I never felt more right about what I was doing. Can I have one more anecdote?
It's absolutely.
We were opening
only
up.
Only Grant is stressed here.
I know. I'm going to go soon. I am behind. We were opening up in a Boys and Girls Club in Pilsen. As I'm shaking all the kids' hands, some like 12-year-old looks at me and goes, are you the mayor? And I go, yeah. He goes, are you the guy trying to put more make me stay more time in school? I go, yeah. He goes, oh, like that. I go, when you're 23, you'll appreciate it.
All right, we have one last question for you, and it's the question that is like the hallmark of our podcast, which is called Make Me Smart. So I encourage you to think outside the box here.
Is that like better than the last 30 minutes?
The Make Me Smart question is, what is something that you once thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about?
I would say I've always believed that even in the worst person, there's good. And I'm not sure that's true.
Mr. Mayor, thank you so much.
Yeah.
So that was a fairly downer ending to what was really a fairly interesting give or take. And I will say that he was like, well, let's just say I know evil exists in the world now. And you know, the guy's, interesting dude. That's all I'm going to say. Lots of interesting stuff.
I would say, you can agree or disagree with his positions. And he is somebody who will look back throughout history and say, yes, I thought that Obama should take a much more incremental approach to Obamacare, for example. But I don't think that you can really question his motivation. I found him sincere in the reasons that he wants to do the things he wants to do. But to go all the way back to that first question that you asked him, which is, why do you want this job? Or as we kept saying, what is the upside to being the mayor of Chicago? It's clear that he takes this all very personally. He considers it a personal sense of duty thing. And I thought that the sense of conviction there was really interesting.
Yeah, I think that's
and
totally
believable.
True. Yeah. Let us know what you got out of that interview. What you think of what's going on in Chicago, or what you think of us spending so much time with the mayor of Chicago, or anything at all that you hear on this podcast. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Let us know. And here are some other folks who did that.
Where do we mail a letter?
All right, we got this message from Mohammed Zishan Naimuddin, who really related to Satya Nadella's story in last week's podcast. If you missed that, go back and listen to the Microsoft CEO, to his story about the importance of education, which is frankly a lot of what the mayor was just talking about.
Hey guys, love your show, especially love the banter. Nobody ever comments on the banter, but it's fantastic. Anyway, I was listening to your episode with Satya Nadal, and when he spoke about education and how it's a way out of poverty, it really hit home for me. My sisters and I grew up in a very poor household. The three of us and my parents at one point were living in a one-bedroom house, and it was pretty bad, but my parents focused on education, and as a result, the three of us, who are all products of the Jersey City public education system, no charters or anything, graduated, went to Rutgers, which is a public university, and are now all three of us very specialized physicians. So, you know, education really does work. And then on last point, the government, through federal loans and whatnot, I think paid somewhere close to about $100,000 for each of us in grants throughout all of our education. And now each of us pays back hundreds of thousands of dollars in taxes per year. So I'd say that's a pretty good return on investment. Anyway, thanks. Love your show. Have a good one.
So Zeeshan is a physician, as he said. He does what he calls HIPAA-friendly storytelling. HIPAA is the Patient Privacy Act that came out probably, God, it was probably like 5 or 8 years ago now. He works in an intensive care unit, tells stories about what it's like to be a doctor. He does story slams, and he organizes them for other doctors as well.
That is so awesome. Zeeshan, I want you to like record a story slam and send it back to us. Amazing. Finally, on yesterday's Facebook Live video, Samantha Price asked us how she can get one of those newfangled Make Me Smart pop sockets. All right, Samantha and everyone else who has asked, we are working on it, working on some sort of bulk solution.
Yeah.
But Samantha, since you asked so nicely and showed up at our Monday editorial meeting, if you send us your address at makemesmart@marketplace.org, we will send you a pop socket.
It's going to be awesome. Review us, would you, on Apple Podcasts. Tell a friend. Check out our Monday editorial meetings, Facebook Live. It's noonish or so Pacific time. We usually tweet about it and get the word out there. But let us know what you think.
Yeah, subscribe to the show. Tell your friends. And thanks for listening.
Oh, look, it's the close music. Or better yet, listen, it's the close music.
Oh, here comes the good part.
Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Bridget Bodner, Cerise Castle, and senior producer Nancy Fargali. This week's program was engineered by Ben Talladay as he looks up to the glass to make sure that it is actually Ben at the controls. Theme music was composed by that very same Ben Talladay, also Daniel Ramirez.
Thanks to everybody who wrote to us last week to say that the what happens later in the music is not a key change. It's like a bridge something or other. I don't know. All
That's
I know
so
is
funny,
it's great.
Because I was listening and I was like, I don't think it changed.
No, whatever. Anyway, I really like it. It's got kind of a Stone Roses vibe. Anyway, the executive producer of Marketplace is Sitara Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. God, no wonder nobody ever talks about the banter. Not true, by the way. Everyone does. It's our favorite part.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.